The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Yes, Conor Nyland, the former professional tennis player, was with me last week placing his favourite reads in the Hard Shoulder bookshelf. Barbarian Days by William Finnegan was his choice. And if you haven't read Conor's own book, The Racket, it is absolutely brilliant as well. Anton Savage, though, is with me, News Talk presenter, of course, to pick his favourite reads this week. Anton, how are you?
I'm good, Kieran. How are you?
I'm great. Listen, thanks a million for doing this. So have you a book that we are placing up there first and foremost?
Yes, I do. I've one
first among equals.
This is one of those where I'm always confident in recommending it to people, and I recommend it willy-nilly.
So all right.
If you haven't read it, you really should. It is a book called Factfulness by Hans Rosling. And Hans Rosling was a Scandinavian public health doctor. I use Scandinavian because I'm not sure was he Swedish or Norway, but he's that general of his.
Yeah, he's up there.
Exactly. Yeah. And he wrote this book. The subtitle on it is 10 Reasons You're Wrong About the World and Why Things Are Better Than You Think.
Okay.
And he makes a thesis that causes you to, well, caused me anyway, to fundamentally review what I thought about the world and my assumptions about the world. But he makes the thesis without any proselytizing or advocating. He just sort of lays the data out. And he does in a number of chapters, he asks questions as precursors to the chapters. He goes, well, you know, what proportion of the world do you think is poor? What do you define poor? Is it this? Is it that?
Mm.
And then by five pages on, you discover all of your worldview is totally wrong.
Really?
Yeah. So can I give you one example?
I happen to dig out
a very old copy of it, but he has one small example. He says, last year, so I don't know, this was 2008 probably, so it's a few years ago, but says last year, 4.2 million babies died. That's the most recent number by UNICEF. And it tends to produce a reaction when you say it. And most people say, well, isn't that horrendous? And he goes on to say that back in 1950, 14.4 million babies died. We are exponentially better than we were, though we think we have a crisis. And he does that kind of thing all the time where he challenges your numbers. He also has a very interesting analysis where he shows that demographics, richness and poorness, means more than nationality. Poor people in Ghana and poor people in Indonesia and poor people in Jakarta and poor people in Northern Europe are much closer together in their lives and habits and challenges than are rich Irish people and poor Irish people. That what matters in the world and how you experience it is wealth, not nationality. So those kind of things I just find very interesting.
When was the book published?
That is a fine question. Talk among yourself while I...
Well, I don't know anything in exact year, but I just wonder, like, is there a danger that that gets out of date? Or is the general thesis of the book that things are so consistently trending in a better direction that actually, even if you read this 20 years...
It was published first in 2018.
In 2018.
I thought it was longer ago that I had read it. There is a duality to the thesis. The thesis, in the one hand, is of the moment, which is, where are you at now and do you perceive it correctly? The bigger learning, I think, from it is question everything and ask where the numbers are.
Yeah.
I mean, I was intrigued. Your discussion yesterday off the back of the Tony Blair interview that you had with Professor Brendan Kelly, that thing of the narrative says that there is a mental health crisis.
Mm.
Do the numbers bear out the narrative is an interesting question and an interesting examination. And that's probably the heart of Factfulness. And that's what is left with you is that desire to say, is it Plato's cave? Am I just staring at the shadows on the wall and believing them to be true? Or
yes.
Do I go and question it?
Were there specific preconceptions you had about the world that proved wrong? Or was it more just the general thesis?
The one that kind of absolutely proved wrong to me. I mean, it was the general thesis and the general... Don't live on your own assumptions, which is difficult. We all think we second guess our own assumptions. We largely don't. It's an act of will and effort to second guess your assumptions. But one, for instance, was population growth in the developing world. This is a crisis. It's blowing up out of all proportion. And he lays out, again, just using the numbers very persuasively, how there is a simple paradigm that applies all the way around the world. You have hugely high infant mortality rates. You then have an improvement in wealth and you have an improvement in healthcare. The infants that otherwise would have died now live and you get a sudden population explosion and you think crisis. Two generations later, what starts as an improvement in public health becomes an improvement in education and becomes an improvement in family planning. And suddenly your families begin to shrink back and you get... And if you look at the Irish case, we had effectively that pattern. You went from vastly high birth rates and infant mortality in the early part of the 20th century through to now, what, 2 point something as the average family?
Yeah.
that paradigm repeats every time a country develops. Yet when it's in the growth phase, we all think, oh my God, population explosion.
Yeah. Earlier in the show today, we were talking to the defence editor, Shawshank Joshi of The Economist. And he was talking about Michael D. Higgins' comments at The Young Scientist last week about NATO and spending, and he called it disgusting and all this. But what I kind of found, what kind of overlaps a little with this book is, Michael D. said, in the context of a world with rising poverty, rising hunger, rising inequality. And I actually, in advance of the conversation I had with him, I actually kind of went to find out, is this actually true? Are these things rising?
Yeah. Total arse. And this is exactly the kind of thing. Whereas if you, now, I mean, having me now said that's total arse, there will be people furious saying it is not. But if you go again, if I go to Factfulness and I look, he has chapter 16, bad things decreasing is the entire chapter. Yeah. And he graphs it out. Legal slavery, down vastly. Oil spills down. HIV infections down. Children dying. Battle deaths. Plane crash deaths. Child labour. Deaths from disaster. Nuclear arms. Smoke particles. Hunger. Ozone depletion. Child labour. Crime down vastly. And he dedicates an entire chapter to why is it that crime has consistently gone down in the developed world for 100 years while we all roar about crime going up. Yeah. Similarly, poverty has gone down in the developed world, as we said, but we all say this is on the up.
Yeah.
Our narratives and beliefs don't match the numbers.
Factfulness is the name of the book by Hans Rosling. Pride of Place, up on the Hard Shoulder bookshelf. So we always allow people to mention a couple of other books because it's hard sometimes to pick one book amongst everything. What else do you want to mention?
I have a couple of the honourable mentions. One, I thought, is there anything fiction? You know, because not everybody likes
it. Are you not a great fiction reader?
I consumed an awful lot of fiction probably until my early 20s and then just, I sort of went, meh.
Oh,
I don't know why. And sort of swapped to nonfiction. So I've only recently read novels again for a particular reason. If I was picking a novelist, The World According to Garp by John Irving.
Oh, yeah.
And if I was going to have another second one that goes on the shelf, it's a book called On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee.
Right.
For similar
cookbook.
It's not so much a cookbook as a book that looks at the science of cooking. Harold McGee's an interesting guy. He went into Caltech to study, I think, either astronomy or astrophysics.
Yeah.
Changed to English literature. And at some point was cooking and was told by a friend, you should use a copper bowl to whip egg whites because you get a better foam.
Okay.
He said, what?
Why is that now?
Yeah. And he ended up publishing a paper to Nature about the bonding of sulfur ions or atoms in a copper bowl and how they interact with the albumin and egg whites. That became this book, which effectively just looks at how does protein behave? How does fat behave? How do carbohydrates behave? At what point do things denature? So it's not so much a book of recipes. It's what happens to everything when you cook it.
Yes. And I guess, so it's where cooks kind of learn the consequence of what they're doing in terms of taste and flavour. He's explaining what's the causation of that taste and flavour.
Correct. And what are the variations on a theme? Like, I'll give you a case in point. Most people would believe that you have to cook, let's say, chicken or turkey too. I think it's meant to be about 70 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
But actually, that's a 7-log diminution in bacteria in the poultry, which is a function of both heat and time.
Okay.
So you can cook it to 35 degrees if you hold it there long enough.
And you can actually
serve the... Now, don't do this because you need to have very precise measurements. But you can serve the equivalent of medium-rare chicken as long as it's been held medium-rare for 7 hours.
Oh, wow. So
all of that kind of thing of, oh, okay.
It's kind of Heston Blumenthal.
Heston Blumenthal says that the book that most influenced him in becoming Heston Blumenthal was Harold McGee's On Food and Cooking.
What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading two things at the moment. I tend to sort of grab a whole lot of stuff at the one go. So I have a couple of books on the go. The most interesting one is Dickinson's Dublin, The Making of a Capital City.
Oh, yeah.
Because where we are, every time that I go home from News Talk, I go through College Green.
Yeah.
And I found myself thinking, every building here is a bank. Every single one. You look at, they're now all shops.
Yeah.
But what were they? They were all banks.
Yeah.
And they're all palaces to capitalism. But when we were, well, at least my experience in school was, you didn't mention that mercantile Dublin. That was Anglo-Irish. It doesn't fit with the peasant Celtic mist and narrative
exactly,
that we like.
Yeah.
So let's not talk about
Cumbly maidens dancing at the crossroads.
Exactly. We got the Brits out and all as well. Yeah. I was like, steady. We were doing something to build all those Georgian houses. What was it?
Yeah.
So Dickinson's Dublin gives a look at that. I mean, it goes from, almost prehistoric all the way up, but it treats that period of Dublin as the second city of empire.
Yes.
What was mercantile Dublin and all that. So I'm enjoying that. And the other one that I have to, again, one that I would recommend if you haven't read it, a couple of months ago, I did this thing for Temple Street, which was a journey on Route 66 from Chicago to Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And a little plug for Children's Health Ireland, another one on in 2026. So if anybody has a bike and is interested,
oh, wow,
they can go on the website and have a look. But
no, push bike's not allowed.
No, but, well, if you can you can it fast, yeah, it's going to be a hard journey. So
are you doing the same route again? Sorry, this
it's always the same route. Okay. It is Route 66, which was the original road from. It was effectively the first connection from east to west.
Yeah. Okay.
Continuous road across the U.S. But Route 66 is known as the Mother Road, and where it got its name was from the Grapes of Wrath.
Oh, Steinbeck.
Correct. So the Grapes of Wrath looks at the Dust Bowl, the Depression in the 20s and 30s. And particularly what it did to the people of Oklahoma as industrialized agriculture came in, as the land went rotten, as families found themselves destitute, they went in a wave of immigration across the states. And I actually brought, I mean, to give you an example of it, one of the things that Steinbeck does, the book's hard yards.
Yeah.
It's fibrous.
Yeah.
You know, you're chewing a lot, but it's worth it. It is worth it. But what he does is he has chapters of the novel looking at the family making their escape from Oklahoma, and then he intersperses them with sort of soliloquies, sermons, eulogies from his perspective. And he has one line that explains why Route 66 is known as the Mother Road. He says, 66 is the path of people in flight, refugees from dust and shrinking ownership, from the desert's slow northward invasion, from the twisting winds that howl out of Texas, from the floods that bring no riches to the land and steal what little richness is there. 66 is the Mother Road, the road of flight.
Oh, wow.
It's good, isn't it? Isn't it? Not bad. Yeah,
it is. He knew it all right.
He did. And there's an interesting, can I tell you one very interesting one that I discovered out of that? Yeah. There's one final book that I'm reading on the back of that, which is a book called Whose Names Are Unknown, right? And it's by a woman called Sonora Babb.
Yeah.
Sonora Babb worked for the government in the States during the Depression.
Okay.
She worked with the poor and the destitute and the people living in the Hooverville tent villages. And she wrote up her notes. Most of them in the public domain because she worked for the government. She got a contract with Random House to write a novel on the basis of this.
Okay.
She gets an advance. She begins to write the novel.
Oh, I can see where this is going.
Her
it's
notes,
like that. It's like your man who wrote The Origin of the Species, this famously kind right. of, but a week too late.
Her notes are discovered by the man who works as the editor for Steinbeck. He says, you've been doing stuff in this area. You might find these interesting. Steinbeck reads them, publishes The Grapes of Wrath. Random House rings Sonora Babb and says, there ain't the market for two of these.
Wow.
So Sonora Babb's book was published in 2004, 68 wow. years after she wrote it. So I'm currently reading that to see if it measures up.
That's good. I'll tell you, we'll wrap up. I have a Steinbeck adjacent story. We were on the, like a big trip like that, the Trans-Siberian Railway. And we were, myself and my friend, and we brought a book each. I brought East of Eden. And he brought a book called River God by Wilbur Smith. Wilbur Smith wrote these series of books about kind of historical fiction about kind of the pharaohs in ancient Egypt. And when we were crossing from Mongolia into China, the censors come on the train to see what reading material you have, because they don't want kind of people, in case you've got stacks of Bibles hidden on you and you're kind of there to preach or whatever. So, or newspapers, maybe, that there's kind of articles of I shouldn't be kind of getting into. This is 17 years ago. I'm not sure if it's the same now. But she looked at Steinbeck and she was looking through. We were explaining. She asked what the story was. You know, we eased off on the religious allegory, but we kind of said, you know, it's a story and they're kind of, you know, the great American novel, blah, blah, blah. And then she picked up this Wilbur Smith book, River God, and she started to ask it. And we said, you know what? You can confiscate it. She took it. So maybe it's still on the banned list in China. I don't know.
Well, can I give you a nice one to bring us absolutely full circle? There is a certain irony that we end up talking about Steinbeck, because the producer, researcher responsible for this item,
yes,
Caleb, is named thanks to East of Eden by Steinbeck.
Easy. I didn't know that. There you are. Anton. Thanks a million. Anton Savage. We will be back at the same time with the bookshelf next week.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.